How many people here are not from the United States? There's a very peculiar thing that goes on in Texas every decade, which involves evaluation of all kinds of textbooks, not just biology. What I want to cover today is entitled Biology Textbook Smack Ban. Thanks to Randy's advice and really the way things work, no theology and maybe a little worldview in this. The book is one of the most popular books used in biology today. It's Miller Levine, and this is a book where it's good, it's very, very good. Where it's not, I would contend it's incomplete, and if there is any worldview implication there, let's look at that. We started late, so we're going to have to move fast. Randy suggested that I point out at the beginning that we should have nothing about religion or metaphysical speculation when we're looking at these kind of things, that we should use the dominant scientific understanding, and it needs to be appropriate to the level. This is the basic high school biology, not the advanced placement biology. And to the extent that there are controversies out there, be very careful. This is really, in a way, ancient history. It was done a year or so ago, but the winners had a victory lap, shall we say, in a magazine called the Texas Monthly. They had an article called The Textbook Wars Are Over. The title of the article was interesting, Evolution of the Species, so you can sort of see where they're coming from. What ended the war? Well, there were three experts. What did they do? They struck down an attempt to insert doubt about evolution in high school biology textbooks. How? By preventing creationists, a universal derogatory term, from having any voice in how the origin of life is presented. Science didn't just win, it crushed, it smacked down. Well, let's see. The creationists were concerned about the origin of life, we were told. They missed the target. The origin of life was not one of the issues that was being dealt with this time. A decade before, there had been a lot on that, and that was how I got interested in this, because of the work that I'd done in chemistry, catalysis, and polymerization. Miller and Levine's much better on origin of life. They had this quotation from Jack Sostek, the exact circumstances of the origin of life may be forever lost to science, which was sort of underlined by Friedland's talk yesterday. Should creationists have a problem with that? Oh, I don't. I did have one problem, though. The text glosses over any reason as to why that might have been the case. I'm going to zoom through the sequence in Texas, but every 10 years they put together standards. These standards are attacked by people who think they're a little bit too conservative. There was a big fight in 2009. Texas, for two decades, had required all theories, their strengths and weaknesses, to be discussed. That was knocked out. It was replaced by analyze, evaluate, critique all theories, and people didn't like that very much either. It became sort of immaterial because new legislation said none of these standards, or only half of these standards, need to be followed. And the interesting part is they retained the requirement that there be no factual errors. Factual errors sometimes are in the eyes of the believer. Let's look at the three experts. These are all people that I have worked with over time. Vincent Cassone, the second one, actually has a history in this. He was given a contract to evaluate the criticisms of the biology textbooks in 2004 and said, yeah, there's some problems there that they need to fix. And he's the only one who came up with a problem this time as well. The principal protagonist of the other side is an evolutionary anthropologist from SMU, author of readings in the history of evolutionary theory. He and I were taped for about 4 hours by NPR on all these matters, so he was fully familiar with what I had to say, and you can see he didn't hold them in very high regard. Non sequiturs, irrelevant, simply a morass of pseudo-scientific objections. We are not moving. What do you suppose happened?
It's what you said.
L was objective. I was hitting the page button.
Yeah.
let me go ahead with some of the things that that will be coming along. Yeah, that's the one.
I jumped too much ahead.
This goes back to the testimony in 2009 when he was arguing for the taking out of the strengths and weaknesses. And he said, and he speaks very authoritatively, human origins have arguably the most complete sequence of fossil succession of any mammal in the world. No gaps, no lack of transitional fossils. I actually like what the Miller-Levine text had to say a little bit better. Human evolution once thought to be simple, now more like a shrub with multiple trunks. I'm punching too many buttons, but let's just keep going. The other interesting thing that he drug into the discussion was the position of Coelacanthropus tachydensis in this whole operation. You can see from the error, this is a figure from Miller-Levine. The Coelacanthropus is off to one side. Maybe no gaps. So what we're going to do is look at my irrelevant pseudoscientific objections and how did Pearson deal with them. And we don't have time to do all of them. How did Wetherington support Pearson's defense? What we find in Pearson's own Campbell Reef and some supporting material where that might be applicable. First, we struck out in kind of organisms from the definition of evolution. This was not argued about by either Pearson or Wetherington. And Campbell Reese says the same with modification, which may look more familiar. The interesting thing to me was that there was in the 2004 edition, anatomical and molecular data were to be understood to sometimes not agree. Student was told to see that. That was taken out of the 2015 proposed edition. There are lots of places where the agreement is good. They picked one where it was good, and here the student was told to conclude how closely related organisms are. The response of Pearson, he didn't talk about the switch, but they just said there's no contradiction with evolution. Absolutely true. Wetherington said another rant. Pseudoscientific stuff. Basically, my objection was they should have been more careful about how they say it improves accuracy. The accuracy of what? Relatedness declines in a way. They have a sort of a standard tree in figure 18.18. Then they present clade after clade, but they don't really talk about cladistics. There's no consistency indices discussion, no likelihood discussion. Pearson's response to say, well, we did have a case where we moved something around based on the molecular data, and that's absolutely true. Wetherington called it another rant. But it's interesting that Campbell Reese says systemists can never be sure of finding the most accurate tree. And trees have different likelihoods. Keith Miller, who had a very neat article in the last PSEF, said with regard to the metaphor of the tree of life, placing these organisms in their proper place is not simple, it's difficult. The Campbell Reese actually has, as a hypothesis, not a tree, but a ring. With regard to the development and presentation of evolutionary theory, there was a lot on Darwin. The neo-Darwinian synthesis wasn't even mentioned. Punctuated equilibrium got sort of a short shrift. Nothing on epigenetics. One minor little example where they showed an epigenetic effect. That was it. As to the synthesis not being mentioned, this is an interesting quirk about the way things work in Texas. The Pearson defense was it's not mentioned in the standards. So we don't have to mention it even if it plays a role in the development of evolutionary theory. Ken Miller, the author of this book, actually used that defense. He was confronted, by the National Center for Science Education for having included in his text the word strengths and weaknesses. He said he did that so it would pass. We're going to have to roll. Picture's worth a thousand words. This is the punctuated equilibrium picture in Miller Levine. This is the picture of Campbell Reese, where you get a clear indication of stasis and sudden appearance. Now, let me back up and quote one of my favorites, James Shapiro. He says, punctuated equilibrium should be the default. We won't deal with that one. It was kind of interesting. Cambridge explosion is fascinating. A minor argument about how long it took. Pearson came back and said, well, maybe it's 26 million rather than 10 million years. Wetherington didn't deal with it. Pearson's own Campbell Reese has it for 10 million years. What did it do? That's the most interesting thing. The text said some or many originate. I thought most originate. Pearson's response, there's a lot of uncertainty. Quoting a 2000 journal, Wetherington pirated that response. Pearson's Campbell and Reese says half appear. And Irwin and Valentine's definitive Cambrian explosion says all or nearly all. The final outcome was that, bottom line, Wetherington, on behalf of the group, after he had talked to Cassone out of an objection, said, our collective conclusion is unanimous support for the original Pearson text with no recommendation for changes. Carefully avoided saying no errors. Interestingly enough, Pearson had already made a change. They added that phrase in, and subsequently they added in a definition of epigenetics and an index to that reference to the little page that they had in there. So they technically were getting covered. The score at this point, Pearson 3, experts 0. Final prognosis. You're familiar with Thomas Kuhn's oft-quoted book. It takes generations to die off before paradigms can change.
Thank you, Ide. It's difficult to operate under time pressure, particularly issues. We have a very short time for comments or questions. If there are any immediate ones, Alan, would you like to try and be getting yourself set up while we...
If you want to talk about it, I could beat you any time. And there's a fuller treatment that's going to be available.
Thank you.